Activist Bernice Johnson Reagan leading the a cappella group that she founded, Sweet Honey in the Rock, with Give Your Hands to Struggle. This was originally released in 1975 and then reissued in 1997. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And your president, I give him to you, you can have him. Your president is now the comforter-in-chief of the nation. He is paying a visit along with the First Lady, Melania Trump. They're in El Paso trying to comfort people and paying an official visit to the site of such devastation. Well, the consoler-in-chief insists that the contention that his racism, his open and unapologetic racism, has nothing to do with influencing anybody to do any violent acts. He just disavows that. But just the same, just to remind you, in El Paso, where he should be by now, which is still reeling from a lone gunman's unprovoked attack on August the 3rd that left 20 people dead and 26 wounded. Trump says the attacker suffered with mental illness and was not motivated by racial hatred. He said, disavowing any influence his racist rants and white nationalist ideology may have had. In the aftermath of this and other recent mass killings, however, Trump's racist beliefs have been cited as a key influencer for the gunman's attacks. In Virginia Beach, on May the 31st, 12 people were killed and 6 wounded in a lone gunman attack. Within hours, in Dayton, Ohio, 9 were killed and 27 wounded in a similar attack. So we await Trump's contention that in no way did he influence these mass killings. As we know, a lot of people think so. A lot of people think that his racial rhetoric, his vitriol, certainly shaped the mood, set the tone for racial incidents and killings all across the nation. But somehow, people find that that is impossible. There are people who say it couldn't possibly be the case that somebody says something and it impels people to follow through with these incipient ideas that have been, they've been brooding on. And because Trump says it, they say, well, see, I wasn't off the mark after all. The president agrees with me and my thoughts that I've been harboring for a while. And we have had, since the election, since he originally won the election, we have had an upsurge in this open hatred, an ideology that people hadn't seen in years. To find something similar, you'll have to go back to the days of the the founding of the Ku Klux Klan, when people had no problem being very open about their intense racial hatred, and followed or coupled with intense violence directed at others. So that's what we're talking about today. Is this president responsible for the upsurge in these kinds of vitriolic and racial attitudes, racist attitudes? And to your mind, has America backtracked on this question, in the sense that, you know, we think of the 60s, for example, as a liberal time, a time of change and people opening up to see the world as it really is, not the world that they imagine it to be. But more than that, they saw themselves as contributing to creating a new dynamic in America, moving away from those barbaric days and trying to create a new reality in America. And, you know, that was when I came to America. I came at a time when, you know, the hippie movement and love and peace and all of that, this was part of the national culture taking root. People moving away from the racist attitudes of their parents and grandparents and attempting to bring in, usher in, a different way of seeing the world and of interacting with it. And of course, it lasted for a while. It did, I think, help to bring people's awareness to the idea that America had been locked in a kind of vacuum, a racial vacuum. And more than that, that it couldn't survive. It just had no future going down that road. Other countries that America had categorized as backward, as undeveloped or underdeveloped, were far ahead of this country with regard to how they envisioned a nation functioning. That it can't function well when you have all this factionalism and you have this internal hatred, and frequently leading to massive outbreaks of violence and death and killing. There was no progress in that. And this was especially true in the thinking of nations just coming into their own. It was very important in these nations to insist that people make a very strong effort to overcome their past. They didn't create their past in that sense. Their past was hinged to colonialism, imperialism, and nationalism, all methods of dividing people. And for the sake of maintaining dominance over them, that they would be independent, but in name only, because by the time independence was declared, they had a bundle of problems to solve. First and foremost, the problem of bringing a nation together. Many still haven't achieved that. Not since the days that they were jettisoned by their former colonizers, who said, well, look, if we have to give our property back, at least let's not take on the burden of helping them to make a smooth transition. We keep them still saddled with internal strife and all other problems that are attendant to that. And we will still be able to say, see, they can't be depended on. They don't know how to govern themselves. When we know that this internal matter of dealing with factions and groups who couldn't get along because they were taught that it was engineered so that they couldn't get along. Here we have the same thing. We just don't associate it with colonialism or imperialism, because the United States, after all, isn't colonial. It's not a colonial country. It's not an imperialist country, is it? We don't have those kinds of problems. We are a nation that has led the world. It's the most progressive nation in the world. No sign of internecine warfare here. But then you see. And now that it is exposed again, we are being encouraged not to pay attention to the 1900s and the 1800s and the 1700s, when mass violence, mass slaughter was the order of the day. Read any fairly written history book, or just ask the people of the First Nations, what happened? How is it that their numbers dwindled to practically nothing like it used to be? Did they kill themselves? No. It was mass killing. Industrial strength, mass murder, genocide. And they kept it up for centuries, just annihilating people on the basis of race. They're coming in, they want the land, they want everything under it and over it and around it and in it. It is no different from the massacres that we recently witnessed in this country. It's the same mindset. I am a member of the ruling class by virtue of the color of my skin, by virtue of the license I've been given to do whatever I want to do. This is my country. I own it. I own everything in it. I own the people. I can dispose of them at will. And I have learned how to maneuver myself. You know, Trump, in fact, made the case. This is a mentally ill person. Well, he ought to know mental illness. He is mentally ill. But imagine that in this day and age, they're expecting, the expectation is, at least from the president, well, you know, it's a sad thing that happened, but we'll get over it, but we must go on. If this president were actually a human being, this country would have been asked to participate in a national day of mourning. But the people killed are not worth mourning. They're not real people. And why are they, because they happen to have been killed, why is that worth a whole day of a nation pausing in respect? Even just on the basis of fellow citizens, other human beings dying the way they did on American soil. Less if you had some kind of human traits about you. Nobody has called for one, and I can't understand why. And yet I do know why. Let's get on with the business of business. We're sorry that everybody, you know, all these people died and so forth and so on. But one, the people who killed them had mental issues. And two, they had easy access to guns, and that was a failure, a kind of institutional failure. And if it weren't for these two key factors, all these people would have been alive today. But we must get on with the business of business. We can't pause. We can't pause to memorialize them. And that too is consistent with the genocides that have occurred in this country all these years, including when the U.S. government bombed, did aerial bombing of the nation's most prosperous black community in Oklahoma. Aerial bombing of a community. And then we live to see an African-American mayor repeat the same thing in Philadelphia, Mayor Good. A black group who was said to be separatists, he burned down a whole neighborhood to get rid of them, including children killed in the process of bombing a neighborhood. So we think that all this stuff is new. It isn't. We saw Waco. What was that? The government bombing a compound, killing everybody. Because it was perceived that there were very radically different political opinions and philosophies that were part of life within that compound. Just kill them. So I just want to caution people that some people might seem to be a bit, how should I say, not alarmed. Not at all alarmed by these mass killings. If you go through the history books and newspaper reports, you would see how normal it is, how regularly these things have been happening. This is nothing new. And we shouldn't fall into the trap that this is new. No, it's just recent. These are just recent examples. But certainly, it's nothing new. How many times, especially during Black History Month, we refer all the time to these incidents, these horrific incidents of violence. How gruesome. How final. And how the government and all the other institutions that should have responded just refused to do so. Because in the end, they recognized that the perpetrators of this violence were following the same, had the same mindset as the government did. So it is not at all unusual or unusually tragic. This has been a part of the underside of American democracy. And that's why I caution people, don't assume that there's just one history. There isn't. Every group in this country that has been assailed to the point of genocidal annihilation has an entirely different history to tell, an entirely different experience with this thing called democracy. We do not have the same history. And the history that many people and groups of people in this country have, the rest of the people don't want to know. They don't want to hear it. They're not interested in the facts. Well, we will live to regret that attitude. And as I said, that if we had proper leadership, this country would pause. This president and the leaders in Congress and mayors and people in city councils would insist that we honor the dead. They were not responsible for their deaths. But there is a president. This is a very interesting phenomenon. A president is the cheerleader for unleashing a new era of race hatred and racial violence in the United States. You know, it's a problem when a country like Japan and Uruguay are cautioning their citizens not to come to the United States because it's too violent. And we ourselves are encouraged to think that these are aberrations and it's well in hand one guy killed himself, so there's no need to worry about him and prosecuting him. The other guy is who is said to be mentally ill, according to Donald Trump, the psychiatrist. And so that is being taken care of because Trump has assessed what the origin of his anger and his mental illness is. So that's fixed. There's not even a sense of compassion to say, this is just so awful. And this does not reflect us as a nation. And wherever it came from, we condemn it. But you can't have a president condemning this kind of violence when he stokes it. He came into office on the back of this kind of violence and this kind of philosophy of violence. Who is the enemy? Who we could live without? Who we should have no sympathy for or concern about? That's what this president contributed. His son is doing the same thing. His son-in-law, his sons, I should say, and even his daughter. The whole family is like that. That's what we have. And still there are people, you know, afraid to come forward and condemn it. So we do have some signs that people are stepping forward and doing the correction themselves. They're calling the president out. They're not letting him get away with these pathetic explanations that he proffers as if he's an expert in every field, including psychiatry, except he can't diagnose himself. So I ask you, and we want to talk about that today. I mean, a couple of days have passed and we've talked about these events, but as almost as people observing the developments, we're not directly in it. And yet we are. Because we see clearly that even though there may not have been a manifesto issued to everybody as to how to think now, what's a new train of thought, on their own, they're getting instructions. They're getting more and more familiar about what to do to those others that are threatening our way of life. They are browning up this country. They're producing children that go right to the ranks of the poor. We don't want poor people in this country anymore. We've had them, we've carried them long enough. This is a new day. This is America, damn it. White America. And enough has been bastardized. The language has been bastardized. Our values, our good Christian values have already been assailed. We have to now go back and fix that. People are moving into our neighborhoods and sending their children to our schools to play and mix with our children. It's the old game.
And you know who knows that very well?
Donald Trump. Why? That's the theme his father developed his real estate on, as the premise, racial purity. Restrictive covenants, they gave it a nice name. No blacks, no Jews. Go to Queens. It's still to that degree. It's still very much like that now. Restrictive covenants. But they can't resist the force of change. People of their kind are dying out, or they're beginning to see that they will lose money by being racist. So they have to change. But this thing is so deeply enmeshed in their minds, in their psyches. They can't let it go. Because there's fear of being overridden by the riffraff. And real white people are becoming fewer and fewer. What is going to happen when the rabble decides to rise up and insist on things like their constitutional rights and, you know, silly things like that? How are they going to deal with that? So they're setting in place now, institutionalizing their formula for eternal control. It would be in place long after they're gone. Long after they're gone. I go back to Donald Trump's dad. He's dead and gone. His developments are still racially segregated. All these years, that hasn't changed. Well, I have rambled on a little bit. We should have some time for you to talk. And let's open the phones right away. I wouldn't take a music break. We'll just go on to 888-874-4888 on this day that the president, our consoler in chief, is doing his thing, all the while building the case that he's not responsible for anything. He didn't influence anybody. He hasn't caused anybody to take their cues from him. And that's the way it is. What do you think about that? Where do you think we go from here in terms of people's national identity, in terms of this whole, are we returned already, or are we in the process of returning to the old formula of white is right? And we're seeing a more intense version of white supremacy, white nativism. Tony from Orlando, you're on the air.
Hi, Eutrice. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling in.
Once again, we're faced with this issue of gun violence in America, not because of because of people being killed by guns, but because of the situations that they're done in. I liken this situation of gun violence in America to the drug epidemic that we face in this country. When black and brown people were dying from drugs, nobody cared. But in the same thing now, you know, when we were killing each other with the guns, nobody cares. At the same time these mass shootings were happening, people were getting killed in inner cities throughout the country. But like everything else, the chickens have come home to roost. This whole Second Amendment issue, that amendment was passed during a time in this country when slavery existed. In my opinion, I believe that that Second Amendment was passed to suppress a uprising from slaves in this country. That Second Amendment was to protect slave owners from being uprisen by their slaves. And right now, although we might not have any more slaves in this country, what they're using that tool for is to maintain their power, as like what you just very well stated, that eventually whites in this country will be a minority.
Yes.
And that's my feeling, you know, that, and that's why you see that even though they're in within their own communities, these mass shootings are happening more often. That's the reason why they're very stubborn to change any of these laws in regards to the Second Amendment, because their argument, you'll hear them always argue that the reason they have the Second Amendment right is to protect themselves from a tyranny type government. But who in their right mind will ever take up arms against the United States of America? First of all, if you were to even try to do something like that, there's laws in the books that state that you're a traitor, you're a treasonist. So that goes in contrary of that. So that whole argument is just full of garbage. And the real reason they have this Second Amendment is to protect themselves against the others. That's my opinion.
Well, thank you. I think you're onto something there. Thanks a lot, Tony, for contributing today. Henry from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Trace, how's it going?
Okay, how's by you?
I'm hanging in there. You touched on a lot of things, but I think one of the key components that kind of caught me and in my observations about it is, you know, one of the biggest things about racism is how well it can hide in the essence of language. So we see racism hide behind laws, hide behind safety. You know, it's like, this is why we can't get a complete grasp about what racism is. So when you see something like Donald Trump, you know, coming to give his condolences, but yet, like you said, not having a national day of mourning, you know, nobody sees the racism behind. Well, I wouldn't say nobody, but a lot of people don't see the racism behind that. And they don't think, and most people are inclined to believe that Donald Trump isn't a racist just because he doesn't use the N-word or he hasn't lynched anybody. You know, those type of racists are obvious. But the problem is that we don't see the unconscious racists or the subtle racists because, like I said, they hide behind language, they hide behind the law, you know, and they hide behind safety.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think Trump will tackle this issue of whether he is in any way responsible for conjuring up or reconjuring in the minds of these attackers and others this warped view of life in America, and who has power, who deserves to have power, and who deserves to be killed?
Well, obviously, what he's going to do is he's just going to basically, you know, keep saying that it's not his fault. He's going to keep saying he's not a racist. He's going to keep saying that the you know, the safest way to protect yourselves in this country is to have the right to have semi-automatic weapons. And he's going to keep doing what Donald Trump does. And obviously, he's going to try to, after a little while, he's going to brush this incident to the side and say that he wasn't responsible for it. So that's what I see Donald Trump doing.
Me too. But, you know, it's always good to watch, you know, how the morphing of the explanations. First, you deny it outrightly. You just say, absolutely not. And it's wrong to saddle me with any blame. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, he can't really explain just to say why it is that so many people think exactly the opposite. So many people, white and black alike, and Latino and Asian, see him as a racist.
Mm-hmm.
He can't get over that. He can't explain it. Well, I'm waiting to see what is his definitive, other than saying, I am not a racist. That's not an explanation.
Yeah.
We
have this thing where, you know, a racist is somebody with a hood on or is a neo-Nazi, and that's not the case. There's plenty of racists that don't have, you know, white hoods and have swastika signs tattooed on their bodies. Those are the ones we can obviously identify. The dangerous ones are the ones we can't identify. Unfortunately, Donald Trump is somebody that we can't identify, but he holds the most powerful seat in this country, which makes him even more dangerous.
Thanks, Henry. Good to hear from
Thank you.
Thank you. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Hello.
I've been thinking about this issue. And what comes to mind to me is that nothing has changed. Now, Donald Trump brings a lot of attention to himself with his rhetoric and whatnot, but people have to get in their mind that this capitalism we have here, from start to where it is now, has a foundation stone that is one of white supremacy racism. So, you know, Donald Trump is not the only racist around or someone who is in those high positions as the singular racist that we know about. It's his style that brings attention to himself. But we have to understand that things are basically on white supremacy racism. Now, as bad as it looks for these people who were killed in these various massacres, for many people, that doesn't seem to worry them at all. He's not going to use some of his base on the basis of a few people of color being killed in these massacres. The point is that we have to understand that the basic thing about this whole nation is involves us in economics. I mean, this is about making money. And the ruling class, who is making the majority of this money in this case, they have to do whatever is necessary to have people contending against each other. So what they have done, I don't know how many times we have to say it, they have gotten the people who have the same phenotype as most of those ruling class people have, that is the light skin and the springy hair and the features that go along with that, who were at one time, their relatives were Africans who moved from Africa and tens of thousands of years ago went to other places in the world, and get them on the same side. So you have a small ruling class of less than 1%, a fraction of 1%, enlisting people with the same phenotype to support them, and the payoff is to give those people some extra benefits. So that is what's going on here. And I want to also say, even if we get to the point where people of color, let's say, are in the majority, that may not change things. You see, in South Africa, you had the Europeans or so-called white people. They were a small fraction, but they controlled the whole country, even though they won, I don't think, any more than 15-20% of the population. So, you know, this idea that things are this way because of, you know, Professor Welsing talked about of genetic annihilation and so forth, that it's really a matter of economics. This is about money for those who rule at the expense of everybody else. And that everybody else, even though some people may not know it, includes the so-called white people, the people that used to have union jobs that paid $25, $30 an hour, and those jobs have been shipped somewhere where they can pay someone $2 or $3 an hour. So the point is, they don't care about anybody other than themselves. They don't care anything about those little white people who are going around and doing those incredibly stupid things like going out and mowing down people with cars and shooting people and whatnot. They have no interest. So the system is not set up. We often talk about democracy. This is never set up to be a democracy. This is a republic, and it was set up for those at the top to rule. This is a republic, not a democracy. If you go to the Federalist Papers, you can find out there's nothing in there about a fondness for democracy. There's no word about democracy in the Constitution. This is no way a democracy. This is a oligarchy run by the oligarchs and plutocrats and helped along by the professional class right under them. So as I see it, things have not changed and they're not going to change. This is business as usual. For most people with the what we call whiteness or white phenotype, if they see people of color making any progress, like during the 60s, you mentioned the 60s, they feel that is a loss for them. In other words, any progress by people of color in any way is a loss for them. And that's what Nixon did with the Southern strategy. So, you know, let's say this. I'm going to leave it here. Things have not changed, and we have to understand this is about finance. This is about money for those at the top and poverty for those at the bottom. And the people don't run things here, and I've got to say it again, if people ran things here, that we wouldn't have any poverty, and everyone would have a home, and conditions would be good for the people, health-wise, and positive for all the people that lived in this society. So we've got to get that in our mind. The ruling class is running things. They're running it in their interests, and we have to understand who this ruling class enemy is and what they're doing to us.
Do you sense that this might be a turning point in the consciousness of people about the reality that we are living?
I wish that was so. But the ruling class has been so good in keeping the people well trained. As I said to, before, education is not something they want to do. Don't mix up education with training. And the ruling class wants people to be trained to maintain the status quo and thing, and keep things just as they are to favor the wealth of those at the top and the poverty for those at the bottom. So the point is that most people are so damaged by the media, which is controlled by the ruling class at all levels, damaged by the schools that are set up for training, not education. Because education means empowerment. If you're educated, you're empowered to think for yourself and analyze and do the things that would make conditions better for you and the rest of the people who live in the country. But that's
well,
not
we
the
have to leave it.
Of education.
We have to leave it there for today. We're out of time. But I want to thank you, and I want to thank everyone for adding even more to our understanding of these recent events and the value there is in taking a moment and just studying these mass killings and what we are to make of them. It certainly isn't over, and neither should our attention be dismissed or dismiss itself from what is being said through the actions of others. Thanks so much for listening today and participating. We come back to each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.